If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. It's Thursday, January the 14th, and welcome back to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen. I'm a research fellow here at the Hoover Institution, as well as the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. Before we get to our guest, a housekeeping matter. You probably think to yourself, how much longer will Area 45 go on, since a week from now there will not be a 45th president? It's something we've thought of here at the Hoover Institution. We'll have a new title for you very soon. The podcast will continue just under new titlement and maybe a broader focus. Instead of just Trump and federal issues so much, we're going to go a little more state and local. So stay tuned for announcement. Our guest today, joining me from the other side of the San Francisco Bay, is my colleague, John Yu. John is a visiting fellow here at the Hoover Institution and a professor at the University of California at Berkeley School of Law. He co-hosts Hoover's Pacific Century podcast with Misha Oslin, and he's Richard Epstein's sparring partner on the Law Talk podcast. John's also an author. His book, Defender-in-Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power, was published last summer. And John is an expert on the United States Constitution. If you've been listening to Area 45 the past few months, he and I did several podcasts right around the time of the election discussing all kinds of crazy scenarios, such as Electoral College mischief, maybe Nancy Pelosi coming president. But John, you, the one thing we did not talk about was impeachment 2.0. This time we're serious. It's a serious topic.
I went and listened to the one that we did last time. And the amazing thing is we predicted everything that was going to happen with the electoral vote.
Yeah.
All the way to the vice president, right? It was amazing. Or sad.
We just didn't get to the part about the Georgia Senate elections and then the part about the, oh, by the way, protest on January the 6th in Washington. So let's talk about this, John. We'll get to Trump judges here in a moment, which is the focus of this podcast. But first, let's do a few minutes on impeachment. You have a very good column in National Review today. And the premise of which is that basically impeachment is warranted, but the Senate should not vote to convict. So you are threading a needle here. Can you explain why what Trump did is impeachable in your estimations, but he shouldn't be removed from office?
Yeah, thanks. I know it's a unusual opinion to have. There are people who think he shouldn't be impeached at all, and there are people who like to see him run out of office as fast as possible. But I think I'm trying to respond to both the constitutional, political, and sort of moral arguments that people are making. One of them is there's this overwhelming desire, I think, in the sight to punish President Trump in some way, to sanction him for his involvement in the events. And I think I respond to that, but I don't think it's necessary to go so far as to maybe break a number of sort of constitutional principles in an effort to convict him of an impeachment.
Right.
Why not just, put down the second asterisk? President Trump is, in history, President Trump is the first president ever to be impeached twice. Isn't that enough of a censure of President Trump for what he did? Mm-hmm. Now, the problem is, in order to go all the way, full bore, all the way to impeachment and conviction, I think there are a lot of problems. The first one is President Trump and what he did. I think President Trump did commit impeachable acts in two levels. One, he definitely has been challenging the electoral count vote throughout. He has been pressuring state officials. He's been pressuring federal officials. He even tried to get basically a mob to pressure, whether it was violent or peaceful. It's a factual question, but he wanted a mob to pressure Vice President Pence and the Congress into right. denying the results of the electoral count from the November election. So I think at that level, he failed to enforce the law. And then he seemed to enjoy watching television of the rioting and the violent attack on the Capitol rather than swiftly calling out law enforcement and the military. Mm-hmm. So I did think he committed impeachable acts. The problem is, and this is a product of how we've rushed into impeachment, the House is not impeaching President Trump for that. The House is impeaching him of the crime, and it is a federal crime, of incitement to right. insurrection.
It's right. The exact words, John, are, quote, incitement of insurrection. And if you read the article itself, it says, quote, Trump, quote, willfully made statements that in context encouraged and foreseeably resulted in lawless actions at the Capitol, such as if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore. So, yes, there's going to be legal conversation about whether or not that is incitement to insurrection. I suppose we could also have a conversation about whether or not what happened at the Capitol amounts to insurrection. I'm curious about one thing, John. Maybe you've thought about this, too. They did not include an article on dereliction of duty, because as you point out in your article, there are two things here. Number one is what Trump said, but secondly, what he did not do when the violence broke out.
And I think this is why actually impeaching and convicting are a bad idea beyond just symbolically censoring President Trump with the impeachment, because the House charged him with the wrong crime. Mm-hmm. In fact, he did not commit incitement. Incitement is very hard to prove. Because we want to protect the free speech values at stake with people being allowed to speak and criticize the government and make political statements without fear of retribution. To prove incitement, you have to show that President Trump called for violence, that he knew violence could occur with high probability, that it was actually practically possible. If you look at what he said in context, he's not calling for violence, you know, specifically violence.
You said peacefully at one point.
You did say peacefully.
Yeah, so you could parse that. So John, explain this. So you point out two things I found interesting in your column. One is you said, to quote you, the founders did not believe that impeachment requires a criminal act. So yeah. I want you to parse a little bit about that. Then secondly, your rationale here is that the senators should not vote for conviction because it'll complicate lives. It's by acquitting, you're protecting future presidents. So number one, explain to me what the founders meant by this. But then secondly, how does acquitting Donald Trump protect Joe Biden?
Yeah. So actually, you said it a lot better than I did in the piece. I wish I'd put it quite that way. Because yeah, actually, acquitting Donald Trump, you are protecting Biden and all future presidents. Because one is the founders, yes, they thought that you could impeach for acts that are not criminal. The constitutional phrase is you can impeach and remove a president for treason, bribery, and then the key phrase is, quote, other high crimes and misdemeanors.
Right.
People like the president's lawyers in the last impeachment trial last year made the claim other high crimes and misdemeanors means the president must have committed a crime under right. federal law. But if you go back and look at what that phrase meant at the time of the 18th century when the Constitution was adopted, it includes unfitness for office, dereliction of duty,
right?
Political offense. In fact, Alexander Hamilton in the Federalist Papers quite clearly says this is not just criminal, it's political offenses against the body politic, not just legal crimes. And so the thing that's unfortunate is that in the two-day rush to impeach, the House could have impeached President Trump for dereliction of duty, as you said, Bill, or for what he did in challenging the electoral vote, but they don't. They challenge him for actually a crime he didn't commit. And that goes to your second question is the framers wanted a removal of the president to be extremely difficult because the one thing they wanted more, you can see the Constitution is ambiguous about a lot of things, but one thing they were very clear on is they wanted the president to be independent of Congress. Mm-hmm. They in fact wanted the president to fight with Congress all the time to check the legislature. So one thing they didn't want to do, because they understood the principle that the power to fire someone was the power to control them, is that they wanted to make it extremely difficult to remove a president. They wanted it to be extraordinary. Mm-hmm. But if you start allowing the House to impeach someone in 2 days, you expect the Senate to convict a president of a crime he didn't commit,
right?
You are making the extraordinary the everyday. And so I argue that the Senate should refuse to convict because that would set the precedent of using impeachment twice in 2 years, right. impeaching for crimes that were not committed, for allowing an impeachment process that had no deliberation or deliberation to it. That maybe the independence of the presidency is more important than getting Donald Trump when he only has less than a week in office and he'll be removed anyway, which is the primary sanction for impeachment.
Let's talk Senate mechanics for a minute, John. And I'd like to point out to listeners that John Yoo, in addition to other things I read about him in his bio, he's also a clerk for a Supreme Court justice and an appellate court justice. And he also was an aide in the Senate Judiciary Committee. So you know how that body works. So we're doing this on Thursday, a day after the House voted to impeach. We don't know when this gets sent over to the Senate. We don't know if the House is going to pocket this for 100 days, as some people have suggested, and let other things go on. We don't know if it's going to land on Mitch McConnell's doorstep a day before the inaugural, or if this becomes Chuck Schumer's matter to handle when he becomes the majority leader after Senator Harris becomes the vice president. A lot of moving parts, John, but there are two questions here I'd like you to interpret for us. Number one, the idea, can the Senate, under its rules, can the Senate multitask? Can the Senate both do its business, which is, I'm not going to get into the Linda Ford comment about Gerald Ford, about chewing bubble gum and doing something else, but the idea that it can divide its day by doing an impeachment trial, but yet also processing nominations. That's a big thing to do in 100 days, plus maybe COVID money and an infrastructure bill. So, question one, John, is can the Senate multitask? But question number two, if 67 senators vote to convict Donald Trump, is he banned from running for president again? I hear this all day long, back and forth. No, he can't run. Yes, he can. So you're turned away in on this.
Two really hard questions. So the first one, can the Senate hold a trial and do the business of launching a new administration, which involves confirming hundreds of nominees, passing stimulus legislation, COVID legislation, whatever else Biden has on his agenda? Under the Senate rules, you can. You know, a lot of people don't understand Senate rules by unanimous consent. So when you see rules about scheduling and orders and what you're going to take up and what you're not, usually that's a deal worked out by the majority and the minority. And usually almost everyone in the Senate agrees to it. So in order to even do it under the rules, you have to have pretty much an agreement between Majority Leader Schumer and now soon to be Minority Leader McConnell that they are in fact going to do that. And a block of senators could easily block that from happening. If they wanted to really go to the mat, they could probably stop that, which would mean under the default rules of the Senate, if there's no new deal between Schumer and McConnell, the Senate must immediately turn to the impeachment when it's handed over from the House.
Right.
And then it has to spend every day of its business, except Sundays. Apparently the rules when they were written back in the 19th century thought Sunday shall not be a day of work, but every other day has to be filled with the Senate trial. And as we saw last year, the Senate trial would take at least probably 3 full weeks on the floor of the Senate. I could easily see it being more because it goes to your second question. This trial would be unprecedented, even in the limited tiny world of presidential impeachment trials, of which there've only been 3. Mm-hmm. And the reason why is because we have never impeached a president after he's left office.
Right.
And there's constitutional doubt. This is an open question, whether the Constitution permits the impeachment of people after they've left office. I can give the two arguments. The textual argument is the Constitution says that the president, the vice president, and officers of the United States are subject to removal or disqualification from office upon impeachment and conviction. Well, after January 20th, President Trump is now private citizen Trump. He is no longer an officer of the United States.
Right.
So the plain textual reading is you can only impeach and try sitting officers. In fact, that makes sense in terms of the punishment, which is removal from office. There's no removal of office for President Trump after January 20th.
So, John, what's the legal recourse then for a private citizen? Could the private citizen try to sue the government saying stop the impeachment because it's not constitutionally valid? Yeah. Or would the private citizen have to wait for the trial to take place? And if, say, he's convicted, would you then have to sue to have the conviction tossed out?
That's a great question. Completely constitutional unknown grounds, right? This is Rumsfeld's known unknown. We know this has been a question. We don't know what the right answer is because it's never happened before. So the only other penalty left after Trump leaves office is disqualification from future office. That's the only other penalty. So suppose the Senate holds a trial. The Supreme Court has said it will never review cases about how the trial is held. Mm-hmm. They've said, actually, it's a case called Nixon versus United States, a Judge Nixon from the 90s. Although, right, anytime a Nixon appears at the Supreme Court, he automatically loses for Richard Nixon.
8-0, right.
Right. So this also was a unanimous case. And so the only way this would come up, actually, it seems to me, is the Senate holds its trial. Mm-hmm. You know, Trump will claim at the trial that this is an unconstitutional trial because I'm no longer president. And then he would have to run for office, win, and then for someone to challenge him and saying, no, you were disqualified from office. You are not actually legitimately the president or the governor of New York.
Right. So
and that's how it would get to the court.
So is he disqualified from the presidency in every federal office, John, or is it
all
offices altogether? Every public office in America.
Federal. He could still run for a state. Like he could be governor of New York, for example.
Governor, he could be governor of New York. He could be dog catcher in Palm Beach County.
Exactly.
Okay. Yes. All right. So interesting. You want to talk about judges?
Ah.
Something a little more pleasant up your alley. So one fascinating aspect of the Trump years is while we tend to look at most matters as Mr. Toad's wild ride, just a lot of just all over the place on things, a lot of message inconsistency, a lot of drama. Judges and federal court appointments were the very opposite. I did some math, John. Here's a chance for you to drink up and hydrate and relax for a couple of minutes. I'm going to throw some numbers at you. There are 870 authorized Article III judges, 9 Supreme Court, 179 Court of Appeals, 673 District Court of Appeals. Aren't you glad, by the way, I didn't ask you for those exact numbers? You could be a jerk on these podcasts.
I knew the 9 Supreme Court justices.
Very good. Your law degree paying off handsomely once again, right? In the last two Congresses, John, there have been three Supreme Court appointments. There have been 54 circuit court appointments. There have been 174 district appointments. My crude math tells me that is 26.5% of all the federal judgeships in America. They're Trump judges. Now, let me further break it down for you, John. So Trump made 54 appointments to the appellate bench. Obama in 8 years made 55. Bush in 8 years made 62. Bush 43 made 62. Clinton made 66. So this is phenomenally productive for a four-year president, though I will point out that the last one-term president who had a Senate under control of the same party would be Jimmy Carter. He actually got 59 appellate court judges through, but he didn't have any Supreme Court picks, whereas Trump had three. I mention appellate because, John, what is the pattern here? Neil Gorsuch appointed to the 10th Circuit by Bush 43. Kavanaugh appointed to the D.C. Circuit by Bush 43. Amy Coney Barrett appointed to the 7th Circuit by Donald Trump. So you can argue that two things here. Number one, what Trump did was just remarkably organized, methodical, and productive. And number two, he's created a pipeline. We don't know when there'll be another Republican president, but he has stocked the bench. Yes?
And that's good. Exactly right. First, people should also remember just the longevity. And also that the courts were already finally balanced when Trump got to office.
Yeah.
So both at the Supreme Court and the appellate level. So even though Trump, if you think about his impact on the courts as being about the same as Obama for over a two-term period or Bush over a two-term period, mm-hmm. but when Trump came to office, I would say the Supreme Court in particular, but the lower courts were in a kind of equipoise between conservative and liberals. And so Trump has basically had the effect of a two-term president of effectively swinging the Supreme Court in a very strongly conservative direction, because it was basically, you know, 4-4 with Chief Justice with Tony Kennedy at that time in the middle.
Okay, so John, explain to me two things. Number one, when it came to judges, who drove the Trump train? Simple as the Federalist Society. And second, what is the model for the next Republican, next conservative president coming in? In other words, they should look at what Trump did and do what?
Yeah, no, you're completely right. It's such a stunning contrast to the chaos and the politics of the very end of the Trump term was how disciplined and organized the Trump appointment process was and filling the lower courts, filling the Supreme Court, not just the Supreme Court, but the bench for the next generation of Supreme Court justices. And also, let me add, over 99% of the cases in the country, federal cases in the country, end at the courts of appeals. They never get to the Supreme Court. So is extremely, it may be Trump's greatest long-lasting achievement after, you know, maybe Biden overrules his tax, you know, tax reforms and, you know, his economic effects start to dissipate. How did he do it is essentially what you're asking. I would think every president after this is going to copy how President Trump did it if they make judges a priority. How did he do it? Basically, I think the judge picking operation and is really responsible for the Federal Society, the responsibility of Don McGahn, who is White House counsel, and the Federal Society, which is, the listeners may know, is a nonprofit group primarily designed by conservatives and libertarians in the Reagan years to create a network of conservative and libertarian lawyers in the law schools, primarily to debate the important topics of the day, but it's become a kind of alternative to the American Bar Association. And it's got a large membership. I've been a member since I entered law school in the 80s, and it primarily a debating society. It doesn't take positions, but it also has served as a kind of farm team for the people who might be good conservative judges. And so what happened in the way it worked was that since you already had this organization, which had identified and cultivated conservative and libertarian lawyers who might be good judges, and then you had a White House counsel, Don McGahn, who this was his number one priority, was getting these judges, and a president who I think gave it pretty much a free hand. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, I think he basically delegated to McGahn almost complete authority to pick those judges. I mean, obviously it's the president's final pick, but, you know, people had all kinds of fears that Trump was going to appoint his sister to the Supreme Court and appoint Judge Napolitano from Fox to the appellate court. He didn't do any of that. He, in fact, picked all the bright stars. And so even if you're a liberal and you don't like the outcomes of these judges and their decisions, they themselves say, look at the young, smart, aggressive, intellectually brilliant people on the conservative side that were. You don't see the usual types. You don't see very many senators, college roommates on the Court of Appeals. You don't see a lot of former senators or losers of races. That's right. Often the judgeships have been like plum assignments for the person who came in second. For a lot. It's not that anymore, at least. And I would think that if you're a Joe Biden or maybe someday like a Ted Cruz or whoever becomes president, they're going to copy that model of using outside groups to help identify younger, more ideologically principled and aggressive judges and put them on as fast as the openings come up. Because part of it was, again, the nitty-gritty of the parts I used to work on at Justice or the Senate was, you have a vacancy occur and then you would spend months, if not years, identifying someone from that home state to pick. Think of it this way: as what the Federal Society and Don McGahn did is they already had the names in line before the vacancies occurred because they had this system out there to identify the talent. And so they were ready to go. And so you're seeing confirmations just mere months after an opening occurred, which is like light speed compared to the way it used to work.
I want to talk about the Supreme Court in a second, John, but as you look around the country, is there a specific circuit that you look at that's affected by Trump? Would it be the DCA? Would it be the Ninth Circuit?
It's interesting. Actually, the courts that were the Trump was not able to change are those two important courts. That probably the most important court of appeals is the D.C. Circuit because right. They hear most of the cases involving involving the government. The Democrats, actually, this is interesting. The Democrats so stacked that court that there just weren't enough vacancies for Trump to fill to balance it out. And that was actually the result of Harry Reid getting rid of the filibuster mm-hmm. against judges. On the floor of the Senate, which of course came to bite them on the backside when it came to Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett. The Ninth Circuit's interesting. The Ninth Circuit, and you mentioned Carter having so many appointments. Mm-hmm. The reason why was not because Carter was fast, it's because this is very clever. Democrats in Congress expanded the judiciary and added dozens of seats all around the country right. for Carter to fill. And the Ninth Circuit was the place where Democrats took the most advantage of that. So the Ninth Circuit here in the West, which is probably the second most important circuit court in the country because of the population it covers and it covers California, that court has always been heavily liberal ever since that sort of packing of it by Carter. Trump came close. I think if I look at Democratic appointed judges out here are now only of a majority of four. Mm-hmm. over Republican appointed, which is probably the closest it's ever been. And so here Trump has had a big effect, but it's not quite the point of flipping the Ninth Circuit to a conservative court yet. That's the unfinished business that would have occurred if Trump had won a second term.
John, what happened to talk of busting up the Ninth Circuit? You heard for years that the circuit should be blown up or at least blown apart and make a circuit of just the West Coast states and Hawaii and let the more conservative inland states have their own circuit. But I don't think, was that ever brought up during the Trump years? Because there, you did have a president who would have signed it and you had a Republican Senate that would have approved it.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a great problem because as you may put, you know, the Ninth Circuit is powerful in part because it is so big. It covers so many people in so many states. It's from, you know, includes, you know, the fastest growing states like Arizona, includes a larger state like California, you know, includes Washington, you know, some of those economically important states like Washington State and Oregon. So it's vast, it's bigger, has more cases than any other court in the country. And it has so many judges, it has 28 judges on it, that it's not clear it's a court anymore or if it's a legislature, because it has so many judges. I just observed that it has more judges now than the first Senate of the United States in 1789 had senators. Mm-hmm. And so some people think when a court becomes so big, it's not really judges deliberating together. It's just voting like you're in a legislature, and that's bad for the rule of law. So the thing is that the interesting thing is, and your, I think your former boss, Pete Wilson, symbolizes this, is that conservative Republicans out here aren't really in favor or haven't been generally in favor of cutting the circuit up in two. That you had a lot of Republican leaders who also want the court to stay together. I think when he was governor, Pete Wilson didn't want the circuit split.
Right.
He might have changed his mind after office, but in office he didn't. And I think that's, so I think that's the issue is, here the dynamic is conservatives in California want the circuit to be big because that dilutes California in California policies. The last thing they would want, and this is the only possible practical division of the circuit, I think, is California becomes its own court, federal court by itself. And all the other states get freed and start. And if you're a California Republican politician, that's probably the worst of all outcomes in the world, is for the liberal Ninth Circuit judges appointed by Carter and Clinton to spend all their time just reviewing decisions of the California government. So I think part of the reason it never went anywhere is that you never got enough Republicans to support splitting the circuit.
All right. John, how well do you know Clarence Thomas? Do you think you can kind of read his mind?
He could seem to read my mind. You know, we had this joke. So, you know, Justice Thomas, the way he runs his chambers, it was wonderful, is that there would be a case that come up with the court, and he would have us four clerks sit with him and just argue it out, like how, you know, how we thought it should come out. And there was a lot of division. And so, as you could probably tell from my scholarly work, I would often say in these debates, very heated debates, I'd say, Justice, that can't be right because the founders thought this. Uh-huh. And so at some point he just said, do you have like a tinfoil little hat with an antenna on it, which allows you to directly communicate with the dead from 1789? And I said, yeah, in fact, I've got two here. Put this one on too, so we can do it together. So that's just something he would say to me as a joke. I would say I can read his mind, but I can say of all the justices, I think he's easier to predict because he's so principled. He's a guy who thinks in a way facts are not as important of the case as the overall principle. And he, more than any other justices, I think, believes in interpreting the Constitution based on what the founders thought. So I wouldn't say I could read his mind, but he is more certain and predictable, I think, than a lot of other judges, say like an O'Connor or Kennedy or now Roberts, who I feel are really swayed by who the plaintiff is, who the defendant is, the peculiar facts of the case, right, and sometimes are willing to maybe deviate from principle or create exceptions or balancing tests because of the facts.
I bring up the justice for this reason. He turned 73 this June. He has been serving since October of 1991, John, so he is now 17th among all justices in longevity and climbing. In two more months, he passes Scalia. If he rides out the next 4 years, he'll be in the top 10. Now, he would have to serve until well into 2028 to catch William O. Douglas, who served about 36 years and 7 months. It'd be doable, though, because he'd be 80 years old, which would still be well younger than Ruth Bader Ginsburg. What I'm getting at is this, John. As you looked at 2016 and the president in a kind of perilous political situation, it was a very convenient time for Thomas to step down if he wanted to, because Trump would have picked a judge, justice replacement to his liking, but he chose to ride it out. So this is why I asked about how well you know him. Does retirement creep into these justices' minds in the political lens? In other words, do they look at who's in the White House? Do they look at the balance of the Senate and they think that, you know, maybe it's a too good time to get out because I'll get somebody in my place who will, you know, pretty much honor my legacy?
First, Bill, it's a good question. It's undeniably true. you know, if you look at least to the early 90s,
right,
you've seen justices who've tended to retire based on the ideological compatibility of the president who would replace them. It's mm-hmm. not partisan. So, for example, Justice Stevens and Justice Souter, who were appointed by Republican presidents, right, became quite liberal on the court, and they retired under Democratic presidents. And that has been true of Republicans, too. Right. So the times where you've seen justices leave office with a president who did not share their legal ideology was for medical reasons. You know, Justice Ginsburg passing away, Justices Marshall and Brennan tried to serve out President Reagan or President Bush, but they just couldn't serve anymore. Mm-hmm. So it's undeniably true that they do. Now, it comes to Justice Thomas. I know there were people out there in the political sphere, even in Washington, who were hoping he would resign, were calling on him to retire while Trump was president. I can say with a lot of certainty that there was no way that Justice Thomas was going to retire. And then putting aside the question about the compatibility of the president, you had three justices positions open up in a presidency of only 4 years. And they do try to, I do think they do try to time it. They don't want there to be two vacancies at the same time. And so President Trump had three, where would Thomas have fit in his retirement? But the second thing, without revealing anything in particular, he's said to me, I think Thomas is really enjoying the job now because he is the most senior justice on the court.
Right.
So he gets to assign a lot of opinions. He gets to take them for himself. He's now, as you can see in this last 2 years, playing a much more robust role in oral argument than mm-hmm. he ever has before. I think the justice is in very good health. I think he's going to beat William O. Douglas quite handily, actually. I think he will serve at least 4 more years and possibly 8 more years.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by this, John, because if you look at the composition of the high court right now, 7 of the 9 justices have been in for 15 years or less. It's a fairly young court, yes, especially by the antiquated standards of previous Supreme Courts. So I would not expect any of those justices to leave anytime soon, unless, as you mentioned, for health reasons.
You could see an Amy Coney Barrett being on the Supreme Court till the year 2060.
Exactly.
It's sort of incredible.
That focuses on two people. That focuses on Thomas, but it really focuses, and you're already hearing the calls for him to step down, Justice Breyer, who joined the court in 1994. He and Ginsburg were the two Clinton picks. Yeah. President-elect Biden has already said he'll pick an African-American woman for the post. Didn't say he'd be the first pick, but said at some point, I think his exact words were, I'm looking forward to making sure there's a Black woman on the Supreme Court to make sure we, in fact, get every representation. That takes us down another rabbit hole of composition on the court, if you will. But Breyer, his departure, which I think he's 84 years old right now, or 82 or 84, so it all adds up. But two questions here, John. First of all, where does Joe Biden turn to for picks? Is there an equivalent to the Federalist Society on the left to say, here's our guidebook to good picks, or is this a little more disorganized among Democrats? And then secondly, if he is going to pick an African-American woman, I'll throw two people at you and get your thoughts, but do you think he will stick to that pledge with his first pick, an African-American woman?
So, you know, the alternative to the Federal Society is the liberal alternative is known as every law school in America. So the reason why the Federal Society started in a way was because there was such a liberal orthodoxy, yeah, in law schools that you need some kind of alternative. And so there's a farm team out there. It's vast.
It helps if somebody makes a list, though. Somebody has to compile a list. So who makes the list on the left?
So you have and this is also a different thing, and I think this is a result of identity politics's importance in the Democratic Party, but not the Republican Party. I'd say the wrong way tends to organize by specialization. So there really is only the Federal Society on the conservative side. But on the Democratic side, you have all these identity groups that are going to be making up lists and sending them in to President Biden. There isn't really a overarching single umbrella group the way there is with conservatives. And then this is going to get to a second point that you raised with your question of the African-American woman being the second pick. This is one reason why I think historically Obama and Clinton were slower than Trump, or Democrats are slower than conservatives, is that even though they might have a list about, you know, who's the best lawyer in California, who might be the best judge in Texas, they then have to, they have a whole nother fight about identity politics that conservatives don't have.
Right.
So conservatives don't just like, we don't have the kind of racial quota system about judges. You just didn't, that sped things up a lot. Here on the Democratic side, even after you go through like asking the deans of law schools and asking the head of the ABA, asking the head for our, you know, these pressure groups like the Alliance for Justice, then they still got to balance all the races and gender so it comes out right. And right. that really slows things. I can tell you, someone who worked in the Senate on the other side when the Clinton administration was in town, the Clinton administration tied itself up in knots with this identity politics balancing when it comes, and it really slowed down their ability to pick judges. You know, so that said, so I do think Breyer is going to retire. He has been there a long time. He, you know, like me, he was a general counsel of the Senate Judiciary Committee, so he's very aware of the judicial politics of the Senate. Mm-hmm. He would know that these next 2 years, while the Democrats have this 50-50 plus Harris as VP majority in the Senate, this would be the optimal time for him to retire if he wanted someone similar to his views to replace him. He is 82, coming up on 83 this year, and he's had a long and distinguished career on the bench. So I would think he would want to retire. And I think Biden has basically made a public promise, as you suggested, to appoint an African-American woman.
I'm going to throw two names at you, John, and see if they get any reaction out of you. One is U.S. District Court Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. She is a former law clerk of Breyer's, I believe, 50 years old. So she's in the sweet spot age-wise. The other one closer to where you and I live is California Supreme Court Justice Leandra Kruger, who was only 44 years old. Her various claims to fame, let's see, she served in the Obama DOJ. She clerked for John Paul Stevens, and feel free to smile, she went to Yale Law. So
immediately disqualifying. I will tell you, Justice Thomas did have a very funny bumper sticker in his office for a long time. It said, "Save America, close Yale."
As you know, with the exception of Amy Coney Barrett, heaven forbid we pick outside of Harvard and Yale. So, and speculation or third is interesting because if she doesn't go to the court, some people think she might first of all go the Kagan route of being Solicitor General first and then get bumped up to the A squad. But are those the two most obvious choices, or is there somebody out there I'm missing?
There's also, I believe, the attorney, is she the Attorney General of New York or the Solicitor General of New York? So, but I think there's the real divide is here, which is, so Brown has been a district judge, you know, been a trial judge. You could say, is that really good preparation to be on the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court is all appellate? And the difference is, you know, you're consumed as a trial judge with running criminal trials, essentially, making decisions on the spot, like the ones you see on criminal, you know, TV shows like Law and Order, which is playing somewhere all the time on TV somewhere. Appellate judges of the kind like the Supreme Court are more like what Justice Kruger is doing here in the California Supreme Court, which is the facts are really not supposed to be important. All these objections about evidence and, you know, all the stuff people love in the drama of the courtroom, that happened years ago. Right. What you want are justices who are appellate in the sense that they are just deciding pure questions of law, really pure questions of what does the Constitution mean? Not so much, did somebody kill their neighbor, right? You know, the drama of the courtroom. And so I've heard very good things about Kruger, in part because she comes out of the Solicitor General's office, as you say, as you point out, Justice Kagan did. And to me, that's somewhat reassuring because the Solicitor General's job is to represent the United States government in the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. They are sometimes called the 10th Justice. Because they're so much a part of the court and the way it works. So the reassuring thing for me as a conservative is that someone who comes out of that office, and I think Kagan has been very much like this, and I expect Kruger would be too, is that they're not going to be revolutionaries. They're not going to be the woke justice. They're at the Solicitor General's office because they believe in what the Supreme Court's doing. They basically work within the doctrines of what the court has done. And the court, you know, now with this majority is become much more conservative. Those doctrines have become more conservative. And I think someone like a Kruger is not going to try to drop a bomb and blow it all up. It's going to sort of work within the traditions and practices of the court. So as a conservative, that would give me much more reassurance.
If I were to put you back on the Senate Judiciary Committee, John, and task you with coming up with questions for both the Supreme Court nominee, but also other Biden judicial picks, what would you like to ask them?
So, you know, the obvious question is, what do you think of Roe versus Wade? That's always a question. Not because of abortion, but because it shows you how somebody thinks about the claim, I have a right to something that's not in the constitutional text. Does the Supreme Court have the right to identify and create new kinds of freedoms and liberties which are not written in the text? And that gives you the broader insight into what is the proper role of the Supreme Court in our life. Should they allow politics and electoral politics in particular solve our national questions? Or do they think that court has this kind of a superior role that can short circuit politics and take over questions that are deeply divisive? I think a lot of justices of both parties are now quite enamored of this idea of judicial supremacy, where it's best for the Supreme Court to decide these hard questions like abortion and affirmative action and religion, guns, on and on and on, rather than.
Is it as blunt as asking, do you believe in legislating from the bench, or is there a more delicate way of posing that question?
No, see, that's what I'm saying. Like, you can't get the answer. You say, do you believe a judge's job is to legislate? Everyone's going to say, of course.
Everybody tap dances, right?
Yeah. So the best way to do it is to ask. So another question that often gets at this is to say, well, what is the worst decision in Supreme Court history and why? You know, what do you, explain why you think a decision is wrong. That can also be extremely revealing. Not the case they pick, but why they think it's wrong. Because you really want to get at this fundamental issue of what do they think the proper role of a judge is in our democracy.
And what's your answer, John, if you were asked that?
Oh, man, there's so many. They get it wrong so often. so a lot of people will say the easy answer is Dred Scott.
Right.
But when you ask them why was Dred Scott wrong, that's going to be harder and more revealing, because a lot of people have never read the decision. They just know Dred Scott's wrong because, or they say Plessy versus Ferguson, which upheld segregation. You say, well, why? Right. And that's the more revealing part, is their explanation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So Dred Scott and Plessy Ferguson, interesting. Are we entering another 4 years of intense courts deciding everything? Because you look at the Republican Party right now, the Republican Party has no power in Washington. If you want to stop something that Biden does by legislative rule or by regulatory rule, you have only one recourse, and that's the courts, as we saw during the Obama years. So are we in for another round of the last few years of the Obama years?
Yeah, that's a great point, Bill. I would assume Republicans nationwide are reopening the Obamacare playbook. Yes. Because if you think, not just was there enormous use of the courts, which also opponents of Trump used as well, right? If you can talk about the resistance to Trump, it was really much of it was court focused, but that was not an invention of the resistance. It was also something that the Republicans did with Obama. The thing that's interesting about the opposition to Obama is it really centered and focused on the opposition to Obamacare, the signature law of the Obama administration. And that battle, as you say, was waged wholly in the courts because Republicans could do nothing to stop it politically in the first 2 years. And so I think you're going to see state attorney generals, Republican state attorney generals, bringing suits to try to stop Biden regulations and any kind of legislation that comes out of the Biden administration, the Democratic Congress. And this goes to your points about how successful Trump was in filling the courts. You're going to have a bench and a Supreme Court that's going to be sympathetic to those challenges. Okay. I think putting it differently, if you had a Supreme Court with the current membership now, not the one in 2012, mm-hmm. I have every expectation that Obamacare would have been struck down by the Supreme Court easily, actually. So you have a much more receptive bench to the kind of arguments that opponents of the Biden administration are going to be raising than you did 8 years ago.
John, how do Republicans organize that effort? Do attorney Republican attorney generals need to start talking to each other? Do you need a group of lawyers in Washington, like the elves who worked on the Lewinsky impeachment case? How exactly do you go about suing an administration trying to block things in court in an orderly fashion? Because it seems to me there's kind of a fine line at all times between, you know, going after administration versus sometimes what looks like just, if not quite frivolous, just really kind of reaching lawsuits.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I don't know how much of the nitty gritty you want to get, and also how much of this is going to be new, because I think what you saw in the Obama years was that you had Republican attorney generals who I think lightly coordinated what they were doing. Mm-hmm. So you often saw this, the opposition coming out of Texas. Right. And then you had a lot of state attorney generals sort of signing on or duplicating what Texas was doing, but it wasn't, I don't think it was that formally organized. At best, they might've been talking through things like the Republican, through attorney generals associations and things like that, or mm-hmm. just sort of ad hoc. I think that became much more organized during the Trump years by Democrat attorney generals. And you saw, but you're right, Bill, the hard thing, you really put your finger on it. The hard thing is not necessarily organizing to bring the suits everyone can tell obviously should be brought. So for example, if Biden issues new rules to try to reduce carbon emissions in some war against global warming. It's how do you make sure that you don't include lots of frivolous and stupid cases so that you, and that was the virtue of Obamacare, was that Obamacare was such an important issue that Republican attorney generals didn't and private litigants didn't bring a lot of stupid lawsuits. The courts and everyone could focus on that one important overriding massive expansion of federal power and regulation. And they came close, right? They actually, the Republicans won 80% of that case, and they came very, within one vote on one issue of completely winning on killing off Obamacare. It was extraordinary, actually, how successful that campaign was. The important thing is you're right, the Republicans, the temptation is going to be sue on everything, try to stop everything, but rather they got to focus their resources and identify the lead and most important case like Obamacare if they want to have success. That's exactly right, Bill.
Let's talk about the Justice Department for a second, another place where you've stopped in your various points in life. You worked at 43.
Can't hold down a job.
That's right. Who wants to hire this guy? Let's talk about Merrick Garland. First of all, the winner of this year's Bad Timing Award, they announced his appointment the same day as the riots in the Capitol. So you get to see it going from front page news to the back of the front page to the box scores, the NBA scores as the day went on. He is the attorney general elect. It's a full circle. He was, of course, the Obama Supreme Court pick who was blocked in 2016. Two things that stand out to me about Mr. Garland, John. Number one, he'll be a wingman AG like Eric Holder famously claimed he was. I'm Obama's wingman. But secondly, I'm rather surprised here because in the ongoing efforts to be woke, I thought what could be more woke than putting in a very woke attorney general, but yet no, they've put in kind of a rather buttoned down white man from Texas in this job.
Yeah. When he was nominated to fill Justice Scalia's seat for a little over 4 years ago, I said, and I think it was true, that he was the most conservative justice nominated by a Democratic president since 1962. Right. Over 50 years. Garland is, and I would just say you're quite right. He dropped rapidly out of the news, and I'm sure that's the way Garland would like it. Right? He would love it if no one paid attention to who he was, no one showed up for his confirmation hearings. But you got to sympathize with the guy. You got to say, like, and you're leaving the DC circuit for this, because he is going to be confronted with a series of terrible, difficult questions. Whereas you say, his loyalty to President Biden is going to be sorely tested with his duty under the Constitution and the laws. So think about all the things he's going to have to decide. He's going to have to decide, what do we do with this Hunter Biden investigation? Right. Should I appoint a special counsel for that? What do we do with the continuing investigation into the origins of the Russia collusion claim? Mm-hmm. What do we do about investigating and prosecuting Donald Trump or the Trump family or the people who are involved with the riots and on and on. I mean, sorely going to test anybody. On the other hand, I would say I'm quite pleased of all the people he could have picked. I'm glad that Biden did not pick an attorney general who would be a woke attorney general who would see, sort of the legal equivalent of you know, AOC, who would see the Justice Department more as a sword to use in mounting the progressive ramparts rather than perhaps a shield. And so Garland, he certainly first came to prominence actually as a prosecutor in the Justice Department of domestic terrorism cases, and did a remarkable job. And on the DC circuit, he's certainly been a liberal, but not extremely liberal. He's also been pretty tough on crime. So from the conservative, from the Republican Senate Judiciary Committee perspective, you know, the staff, you're like, well, this is probably the best we could hope for from a Biden president. It gives me hope, you know, that maybe Biden will live up more to his language on the campaign of trying to bring the country together rather than being divisive.
What do you expect from this Justice Department in the way of social justice, John? You've heard this throughout the summer, yeah. social justice. What could a Biden administration do? What could the AG do?
That's a great question. I should have included that and did not on the list of tough calls that the new attorney general is going to have to make, because the Justice Department actually has a lot of power in the social justice area that it could use, but those are going to be very controversial uses of power. So the Justice Department is organized into divisions. Like there's a criminal division, civil division. The division that's most designed in a way to do this is called the Civil Rights Division. And they can bring voting rights actions all around. They can bring cases against employers for violating racial or gender discrimination policies. They have a lot of authority engage in this kind of change you're talking about. But because of that, you know, the Civil Rights Division also has to be very careful that it doesn't go too far. Take an example. Here's another thing that's going to come up. This would be a great example, a good test of what's going to, is that right before Obama left office, his Department of Education, with the threat of litigation from the Justice Department behind it, was on this crusade to change how colleges and universities discipline their faculty, staff, and students, to make it much easier to prosecute, say, sexual harassment claims, but any kind of claims against faculty, staff, and students, and to basically remove due process protections, like the right to have a lawyer to represent you if you were accused, the right to confront the accuser, the right to bring, examine witnesses. Is the woke Justice Department going to go around and start suing colleges and universities for not restoring those Obama principles? Or are they going to allow universities to have systems that have due process like Americans come to expect? I don't know. But you should underscore your point, Bill, is that the Justice Department has a lot of power in the country to advance a kind of woke social justice agenda if Merrick Garland and President Biden let it loose.
Okay. Two final questions for you, John. I'll let you be on your merry way to McDonald's and McRibs and all. So for the listeners, though, John and I have a shared passion for McDonald's.
Your passion is not for the McRib, is it? You like?
No, I've never processed a McRib.
You've never had one? Oh, Bill, come on, we got to go out and.
I had a colonoscopy last year. That memory is still fresh in my mind.
Well, you got to give the doctor something to do while they're down there. So let's have some McRibs.
I don't know. You know my theory. My theory is that you're just trying to set yourself up for a class action lawsuit down the road, suing McDonald's as you would a tobacco company for hooking me on this. But question number one, John, grade Trump on judges. Give me a little recap on how well he did. Is it an A? Is it an A+, A-, or something less?
Oh yeah, it's an A+. I mean, he has done better than any Republican president ever. Better than Reagan or Bush or Nixon. I mean, you just look at it, the three people he put on the Supreme Court. I mean, they have significantly shifted the court. I can't see any of them sort of becoming a Kennedy or O'Connor of the future. So I think he's been the best Republican president in our lifetimes in terms of appointing conservatives to the Supreme Court and the lower courts. It's astounding. As you start out, Bill, it sort of doesn't in a way make sense given, the chaotic approach to politics in lots of other areas, but he is, if he stands for anything, his legacy is going to be anything. It's going to be the judges.
No, it's a heck of a thing. A guy who is so disruptive and so chaotic as a president, but yet he's done something that's going to affect us for decades now. Final question, John.
Next week, Biden will take the oath of office. He'll give the obligatory, I'm the president of all states. We must come together. We must heal, yada, yada, yada. Yeah. And then we get down to the business of government. So you follow this far more sophisticatedly than I do. What are you looking at in terms of, oh boy, what kind of departure are we in for? Are you looking at a judicial nominee? Are you looking at the first thing coming out of the Justice Department? Are you looking at the first set of rules and regs? Yeah. What's your tell sign for just how much of a departure this administration will be from Trump?
Yeah, Bill, your last one, you put out your finger on the thing the president can do immediately is executive orders and foreign policy. So are we going to see Biden come swinging out of the gates in a progressive direction on new executive orders and in foreign policy, in particular foreign policy? I'd say, are we going to, I could see Biden doing this. It'll be telling. Is he going to immediately re-enter the Paris Accords on global warming and then issue new executive orders and regulations trying to stop the use of fossil fuels in our economy, like trying to stop fracking, as many people in this party want him to do, to place new limits on mile per gallon limits, requirements on cars, on permitting and new power plants and so on. Is he going to start pouring huge amounts of subsidies into alternative fuels and technologies, which were a disaster in the Obama administration? So I think that that issue, global warming, which is kind of, has become such a overriding issue for the progressives. And then to see, is he going to really use the levers of President Trump, foreign policy and executive orders, to try to advance that agenda right away?
Very good. Hey, John, I enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks, Bill. And I'm still waiting to hear what your favorite on the McDonald's menu is, but I think we'll discover that when we go in person somewhere and get some McRibs.
My favorite right now is what's on sale. The app is brilliant, John. And McDonald's has not subsidized this podcast, by the way.
Not yet.
McDonald's has an app. And in Covey, California, best to order on the app and sit in your assigned lane and have them bring it out to you. And the app is kind of genius in that they always offer you something for free or always something two for one. So you're getting more food for less. You're eating more food. You're getting more hooked on it. And so you're saving money, but you're also saving money for a very soon funeral. So it's...
So your answer is to French fries, which is a good answer, because that's what you usually get for free on the app.
Yeah, plus also fries, you go anywhere in America and get pretty much fries tasting the same. So it's kind of a beautiful consistency. Okay, enough plugging McDonald's, but if you're listening, send John Yu McRibs. He'll eat them. You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th president of the United States. In this case, a conversation regarding the Trump record on judges and what the incoming Biden administration might portend. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word, get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for Hoover's Daily Report, which delivers the latest from John Yu and his Hoover colleagues to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is at Hoover Inst. That's at Hoover, I-N-S-T. John Yu is not on Twitter. In fact, he'd probably be off Twitter by now. Probably be banned from Twitter by now. So you have
I saved Twitter a lot of time just by not joining in the first place.
John, you haven't had the joy of seeing your Twitter feed dwindle in the past week. But you can hear John on the Hoover Institution's Pacific Century podcast, which you just did with Mike Pompeo, correct?
Yes, exactly. Great interview.
Good interview. And also you can hear with Richard Epstein on Law Talk. They did a great one on impeachment and the Constitution, which is a must listen. I listened to it. It was great. And also you can check out John's book. It's still available online. I think Amazon hasn't taken it away yet, I trust. Defender in Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power. Anything else I need to plug, John?
No, that's about it.
Okay. Well, good luck for the next month of being on Fox News for foreseeable future doing Groundhog Day and impeachment. I wish you luck. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment. We only have a couple of them left at Area 45. Next up, we're going to talk about political realignment during the Trump era. So stay to check that out when it comes up. It'll be early next week. Till then, take care. As always, thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work, and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.